It's approximately 3:15, and today is Tuesday, February 23rd. President on committee, Representative Vasquez, Representative Tarr, Representative Foster, Representative Wohl, myself, Chair Seaton, remind us all about our cell phones, and Representative Stutz. And we, today we're going to have a public hearing on House Bill 227, Medicaid Assistance Reform. And before we go into that, what we're going to do is put some topics on the record. There are some amendments. We're not going to formally adopt them at this point in time or consider them, but we wanted to get the information out there of what those amendments might be. So if people had comments while they were testifying, they could do that. If at the end of the meeting we have time, if we're done with public testimony, we will then go back to some of those amendments and take them up in more detail for discussion. Representative Vasquez needs to go to a subcommittee closeout soon, so she has a couple of amendments, and we're going to let her go first and present those issues on the put them on the table. So,
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Vasquez.
The first amendment is H as in Harry, 0.7, and basically it deletes the reduction of audits on Medicaid assistance providers or Medicaid providers, and inserts the following language as a basically reverts back to what we have on the books, removes the change that reduces the number of statewide audits that are to be conducted, but leaves the language allowing the minimizing of concurrent state or federal audits. Just okay. Leaves the status quo, but it also leaves in the proposed change about concurrent state or federal audits. We have 3,000 to 5,000, depending upon where you get the figures. We've got thousands of providers conducting a minimum of 75 audits is not an extreme hardship on the provider community. But we do agree that they should not be subjected to a federal audit at the same time they're subjected to this type of audit. These audits are very, very important to maintain the integrity of the system, and in light of the fiscal situation we are, minimizing fraud, waste, and abuse is of very importance.
Okay, and let's put that one aside, unless somebody has a question on that. The topic's pretty well described there. So, Representative Vasquez.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. The next amendment is identified as H is in Harry, 0.8. And basically what this does, it deletes the references and the material with regard to options 1015I and 1015K. These options propose to further expand the regular Medicaid state plan beyond the newly expanded Medicaid group. This is a pure expansion of our existing Medicaid program, and the department has yet to provide the legislature with very robust studies or data to support their broad assertions that adding these options will save money. Adding these populations without carefully considering all of the ramifications of doing so could put our entire Medicaid program in jeopardy and includes a group of people that is not yet clearly defined by the department. While 1915K does come with a 56% federal match, it also expands the number of services that can be provided to beneficiaries. And it expands the scope of services beyond what is now available through our waivers. Both options will grow the Medicaid populations. 1959 options, this has no cap on services and no wait list. If individuals are found to be eligible, they must be served, regardless of the fiscal circumstances of the state. While all these services may be needed, and it's acknowledged we do need to include services for mental health, substance abuse, and traumatic brain injuries, it also can be used to provide services to Alzheimer's and related dementia services. However, because we cannot cap, we cannot place a wait list, this could place an undue fiscal hardship on the state without having robust studies showing how many individuals indeed will be eligible and indeed how much it will cost the state. Once we get into these options, it is unclear whether CMS will allow us to modify anything, if anything, and whether we could even withdraw from these options. Actually, our research indicates that they become both options, become entitlement programs from which we cannot withdraw. This could leave Alaska's funding for all Medicaid services and leaving many Alaskans with care support and services that they need without them. In other words, it gives the feds a great leverage. Once we institute these programs, they become entitlements, they become mandatory, we're not able to withdraw, we're not able to modify, and it's unclear whether we would be at risk of losing further Medicaid funding. That's all I have to say, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And so those two amendments will be available. They're not formally offered yet, but just for discussion, they'll be available after the meeting today, and Representative Talrico has joined us as well. There are two other amendments that I have to offer when the time comes. The first one is H.5, and that amendment adds to Section 5 of the bill to clarify that the department may not assess interest against a provider who self-identifies and reports overpayments to the department. One purpose of Section 5 is to encourage timely repayment of overpayments by giving the department the authority to charge interest on those overpayments. But Amendment H.5 encourages providers to be proactive in self-identifying and repaying overpayments by stating that the department may not charge the provider interest on overpayments if the provider independently identifies the overpayment and repays the department in a timely manner, and we're indicating it's 5 months. This should act as an incentive to providers to review their payment independent of and prior to state audits and to be prompt and forthcoming with their findings. And so that's the purpose of H.5. And the other next amendment is H.6. And this amendment changes the project under Section 15 from a demonstration and research project to a pilot care coordination project, and adds on to its effect. The suggested change to this amendment would change this section from a demonstration and research project designed and implemented by the department to a care coordination pilot project contracted with a third party. The department does not normally pursue research project and is not well suited to efficiently manage one. However, the focused effort to reduce preterm birth through nutrition, which is promoted by this section, is already underway through managed care and care coordination in South Carolina. So by changing from a demonstration project to a third-party care coordination pilot, Alaska can see if we can experience the same kind of reduction in preterm births related to costs and related costs that other states have experienced. So that is H.6. So we have four amendments that have been kind of laid out there so that the public can know what those further amendments to House Bill 227 is. And we also have now for public testimony on HB 227, and I know we have...
There's one more.
Oh. What's that?
Isn't there one more, Mr. Chairman?
Let's see.
I think you have a third one, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, yep, we do have one more. And that's H.9. And this amendment reflects the CMS policy guidance received in October 2015, which indicates CMS willingness to reevaluate the current interpretation of Section 1905B of the Social Security Act to allow the 100% FMAP for more services. Expanded services that would receive the FMAP for American Indian, Alaska Native beneficiaries includes medical travel and services provided by non-tribal providers that have contractual agreements with tribal health facility. And because 100% FMAP for these services would not be cost neutral for the federal government, is no longer appropriate for a 1115 waiver to make those changes, and therefore the language on page 7, line 31 of the bill, directing the department to apply for 1115 waiver for services, quote, provided to Indian Health Service beneficiaries, end quote, has been deleted, and this amendment also deletes the section 11 of 227, which was deleting language that would conflict with the 1115 waiver. So I think that's enough for everybody to understand what that amendment is doing. One thing as we go through, we would like to get some testimony. There is consideration of the of this effect in the current budget, and removing amounts that would qualify not under 1115 waiver but under the new CMS policy. And we would like from the department some indication of the surety of that being in effect by July 1st. And if it is not in effect, not anticipated to be in effect by July 1st, what fiscal impact that would have on the budget if those general fund matching money has been removed. So that's kind of a question I'm just putting out there, because we're going to need that clarification. If the department isn't ready to do that today, we can get that by our next meeting. And let's see. Was Bruce Richards here, or did... No, he's not back. So let's go ahead and open it up for public testimony. Is there anyone who would like to come forward and... Oh, we've got people online. Oh, Becky? Becky, would you like to come forward? Still getting... trying to get a handle on this iPad delivery system here instead of our written... written notes for people that are going to testify.
So, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, I have another committee meeting to go to.
Thank you for joining us for the time you could. And I believe there may be some other members that have some finance subcommittee closeouts as well. So if other members are having to go, don't think they're not wanting to listen to your testimony. We'll get it to them. Welcome, Becky. Would you go ahead and introduce yourself formally for the record and
go ahead
with any testimony?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Becky Holtberg, and I'm the President and CEO of the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association, representing Alaska's hospitals and nursing homes. So I have some brief, broad comments today, and then Ashna will be participating on Thursday with this committee regarding some more specific, I wouldn't even say suggestions. I think it might be best described as tweaks to the bill. But we appreciate the chance again to speak with you. So taking kind of a big picture view of this bill, the bill does several important things. And I want to thank you all for your continued work on this legislation, because I know there have been many, many hearings and more to come. But I think right now it's in a good place, and I want to talk about a few of those things that we think are really positive. This bill articulates a vision for the Medicaid program. I think that's important, that in that intent language there is a vision articulated that talks about things like prevention as a core value. The bill also speaks to payment reform, public-private partnerships, and just general cost reduction in the Medicaid program. So establishing and articulating that vision for Medicaid, I think, is a positive step. It also establishes payment reform demonstration projects, changing, as we've talked about, changing the healthcare delivery system and payment system takes time, and it's going to be difficult and hard work both at the state level, at the department level in terms of their capacity, and at the provider level. So we appreciate the use of demonstration programs and pilot projects to test these new payment and delivery models, and we think that's a very significant and positive portion of this bill. We also appreciate the flexibility inherent in the bill in allowing for different kinds of pilot projects and potentially in different regions. We are, no need to remind us, but a huge state. And what works in one area and in one part of our delivery system may not be the exact same solution for a different region. So we think this bill provides the flexibility in those pilots on both from the standpoint of which model is selected to which region of the state may choose one model over the other. Speaking a little bit to the fraud and abuse language in the bill, we appreciate Representative Seaton's Amendment H5. We encourage some sidebars to be put around the issue of overpayments so that providers who self-report are not penalized in the same way. That I think is a positive addition to this bill. And we do support the efforts to limit redundant audits. It's important for the state to have the tools to address fraud and abuse, but to ensure that in doing so, we're not just simply adding administrative burden to low-risk providers. Administrative burden equals cost. And I think that's important to note, that while we encourage the state to have tools to manage fraud and abuse, when we put in place new programs, new oversight programs that providers have to comply with, providers are then having to add staff, add cost to comply. So there's a balance there, and we think this bill does a good job of striking the balance between appropriate tools and enforcement and ensuring that we have an efficient healthcare system. The bill also focuses on primary care through developing a primary care case management system, and we recognize and appreciate that primary care is going to be the building block for system change. So we encourage the primary care case management project. And it also signals the intent to more fully utilize telemedicine. And while within our tribal health system, telemedicine has been adopted, and I think our tribal providers are recognized as leaders in telemedicine, for several reasons, the rest of the system has not really caught up. And so I think the emphasis on telemedicine in this bill is an appropriate one. So we appreciate the work of the bill sponsor and other committee members in crafting this legislation. We look forward to working further with the committee as you refine your work here and participating on Thursday. We also want to recognize the importance of reform as a long-term endeavor, and that this is not the first year that you have addressed this issue. This is the second year, and probably will not be the last year that we address this issue. And we think that's an excellent path to be on. We won't accomplish reform in 1 year. We will do some things, and then next year we may have to come back and refine those efforts and do more things. So thank you for that. We appreciate the work to date, and we look forward to continuing to work with you all.
Thank you. And Becky, a question. You may not have had a chance to talk about through the association, but the five-month window, we're trying to figure out what is an appropriate window for self-reporting, reporting fraud, or not fraud, but mistakes that were made before there's interest penalty. Does that seem, have you guys talked about that? Does that seem like a reasonable amount of time? And if not, maybe on Thursday you can be prepared to talk about that.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I can't give you an answer today, but we will do some work and come back on Thursday prepared to respond to that question. But we do think that that this is a good move or a step in the right direction, that we want to encourage people to come forward to report overpayments. And just reminding the committee, it's also important we have the playing field is never going to be completely equal between the state and providers, but right now the state does not have to pay interest on underpayments. So for providers to pay interest on overpayments, we want to make sure that there are appropriate sideboards in place so that it's not not unfair to providers.
Okay, thanks. A couple other things that looking at the bill. One was there was some more emergency room doc fixes. Do you see that the language in the bill is broad enough that it encompasses those, or do you think we need to specifically address?
Mr. Chairman, I think it is possible that the language in the bill encompasses that project. However, if the committee really, and as hospitals, the emergency room utilization project is one that we're committed to along with the emergency room physicians. However, I think if it's the intent of the committee and it's clear that you want this project to move forward, then you could put it in statute. You could amend the bill to include the project, and we can come prepared on Thursday to talk about what that might look like as well. So it's really the will of the committee. If you don't put it in the bill, the project still could go forward. However, it's really, if it is something that is important to this group, then I think there is absolutely no reason that you could not include it in this bill, because it's really accomplishing the intent of the bill, which is to better manage cost, better manage utilization of super utilizers.
Okay, thanks. Are there further questions? I had one other question, and it seemed like there was one element that we don't have in here, and that's on dental. And I mean, I think we've covered behavioral health. Although you're probably not the perfect person to answer the question, I really want to get the question out on the table for providers and see if maybe we're fully covered with the dental health aides and those kind of projects that are already there, or is there something that Ashna has seen that may be beneficial, or that do we have a hole in the projects?
Mr. Chairman, as you indicated, I'm probably not the best person to answer the question about dental. However, I think that certainly reaching out to the Dental Society to ask that question might be a good step. And from a hospital standpoint, we certainly support access to dental care, because when we don't have good access to dental care, we end up with people in the emergency room with conditions that could have been very easily treated in other less expensive settings.
Okay, thanks. And we may have them on Thursday as well. So, but I wanted to make sure that the audience that's listening to this can think about it and comment as well. So thank you very much. Really appreciate your testimony. Let's go. See, Eric Jordan, are you online? No, he's not. What's that? Okay. Bruce Richard, is he back yet? Okay. And Kate Burkhart? Welcome to House Hess again. And we go ahead and identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your input for the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Kate Burkhart, and I am the Executive Director of the Alaska Mental Health Board and the Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse, the State Planning Councils for Behavioral Health. My comments today are on behalf of those boards only and no one else. To provide some context to my comments, just briefly, the boards have participated in the Medicaid reform and redesign conversation with the current administration as well as previous administrations for my entire tenure of about 8 years. We have appreciated the opportunity to participate not only with senior leadership at the Department of Health and Social Services, but as an external stakeholder as well. Our primary focus as an external stakeholder was to engage Medicaid recipients, the people who actually rely on these services, to learn from them how we can best reform the system. And so my comments today about some specific sections in the bill, I'll reference what we learned from the Medicaid recipients as well. Speaking just generally about the bill, we echo the comments from Ms. Holtberg about the emphasis on preventative care as kind of an underpinning philosophy for reform. We see these efforts from all directions as being focused on both improving quality and access to care as well as cost containment, which is a priority for the boards and our constituents. A sustainable system is what we are looking to support. We appreciate that the bill before you includes the flexibility to pursue a variety of projects that will help ensure that the behavioral health system becomes the robust system we need in order to make all of the Medicaid reform efforts successful. If primary care is the building block for reform, behavioral health is the linchpin because it is such a cost driver of the system. And because many of the proposals in the bill, the state plan options and the 1115 waiver will allow us to move programs that have up until now been primarily general fund funded to Medicaid funding, which addresses many of our concerns across the system. First, speaking about Section 9 in the bill before you about the superutilizer program, all reports of the current superutilizer program in operation are that, first, a majority of the participants have a behavioral health disorder, so there are constituents. Second, that their access and quality of care is improved. And third, the costs of serving them are decreased. And so we appreciate that the bill contemplates expanding access to that kind of program. I think some people see that as some sort of draconian response to folks who don't use the healthcare system the way we think they ought to, but in fact, it provides supports and guidance to people so that they receive the services they need in a timely fashion. Moving to Section 12, which is the section about the state plan options and the 1115 waiver, I have had the privilege of serving on the steering committee for the state plan option project design, and I am I firmly believe that that is a way to improve the way we deliver home and community-based services and refinance services that right now rely heavily on general fund, the general relief programs that help house the most difficult to house. And so I know you have some amendments before you that would remove the state plan options from this bill. We would encourage you not to do that. We would not support removing the 1915 INK from the bill. The 1115 waivers are where the experts and our deliberations have led us to believe we can have the most impact on the behavioral health system. It is a very flexible form of reforming the system, and so we appreciate that that's included in the bill. Sections 13 and 14, which are designed to increase access to behavioral health services by removing the requirement that an entity be a division of behavioral health grantee in order to bill behavioral health Medicaid, we believe that that is an effective way to increase access. We would, however, caution that the statutory change is not, that's the start. There will need to be regulatory changes in order to accomplish the goal. We also would caution, as Ms. Holtberg did, that administrative burden equals cost. And currently, the administrative burden for community behavioral health providers that are billing Medicaid now is pretty significant. And so we would want to see a level playing field for the private practitioners if they enter the behavioral health Medicaid system. Those are the specific sections of the bill that I wanted to speak to. Again, the boards certainly support reform efforts. We have been part of them for a long time and anticipate being part of them into the future. We appreciate the care and consideration that this committee has put in to this bill and look forward to seeing it move into other committees for additional consideration. Thank you.
Thanks. So let's see if we have questions. Can you go back to the INK waiver and give us a little more detail on why you think that those should not be amended out of the bill?
Yes, sir. I can, Chairman Seaton, I can speak most about the 1915I because that was the area where the boards were most focused because that those are the home and community-based services that would benefit the most disabled. So my understanding of how that state plan option is proceeding is that in the end it will allow folks who are highly impaired by their disabilities, whether it's a developmental disability or a physical disability or in some cases a behavioral health disability, to receive more coordinated and comprehensive home and community-based services. So we're not adding people, we're just changing the delivery system, because many of those people are right now being served by general fund programs, which if you look at the fiscal notes to the bill lays out the general fund programs like general relief that serve the and the grant programs that serve these folks. When we initially engaged as a partner in the 1915 I and K state plan options, we anticipated that folks with serious mental illness and chronic substance use disorders that are highly impaired, but for the receipt of home and community-based services, they would be in an institution, whether that's the institution of prison or homelessness or the psychiatric hospital. So that's why we were engaged in this process, because we felt like this was a mechanism to better serve that group of our constituents and finance it in a more sound way. Over time, and with the help of the contractors and both at the national level and here in the state, it appeared that in order to achieve the recommendations in the report provided by the administration, the 1115 waiver was a more flexible option. That doesn't mean that someone with a serious mental illness who is so impaired that they would meet the ultimate functional criteria that are set in the 1915I wouldn't be eligible for services. But what it does mean is that for behavioral health, the focus is going to be on the waiver, the 1115 waiver, and not the 1915 state plan options. And if John Sherwood is freaking out behind me, he should come up and make sure I'm explaining it right. So our commitment to the state plan option was because we thought this was the answer, and then we got smarter and we realized that perhaps the answer was the 1115 waiver. So I think that's responsive to the question.
We're trying to figure out where we're going, and you know, there was a we're trying to figure out who is going to be available for these services, and you know, we've had things, statements that we're not sure of. The wait list is there, and does that mean that they're not receiving services now, they're all eligible for services, or whether they are already receiving services but they would receive, you know, we're unsure. So hopefully we can ask the department so that when we have the round table, we can have a graphic or something saying, here's the bucket of, here's the group of people that qualify for this and are on the wait list, and who is going to qualify, you know, what services they qualify for now and what they would qualify for under the program, or if we don't adopt the program. It's, I'll just say for myself, you know, this is a complex situation where we have all of these different identified groups, and knowing how the services are provided or alternative services are provided, and whether we're expanding the population or we're just providing services under a different format, is something that's very hard for us, or at least for me, just looking at words to get my my head around. So I'm just asking that as people come forward with solutions or with comments, that it would be very helpful for us to, as we go forward and consider this, to be able to see some pies or some graphics or something that would allow us to visualize the populations and expanding or not on and services. So that's just a hint to people when they come forward. If they could do something like that, that would be helpful to me and I think other committee members as well to understand. Does anyone have any other questions on behavioral health or on anything here? So I guess the only other question is if we're missing something, we'll look forward to people come bring forward that on Thursday so that we can figure out where that is. So thanks very much.
Thank you.
Let's see. And Bruce Richard, he didn't get back yet. And Commissioner or Deputy Commissioner, do you wish to come forward and add any information or clarify anything for us at this time? Welcome again.
Diana, Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Nuhagala Kamishamakana and Valerie Davidson, Commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services. And with me today is
John Sherwood, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services. Great. And it's not public testimony, but we're inviting you to testify or to give us any suggestions that you have as we go forward. We will have the Thursday roundtable discussion. It's not going to be a formal hearing. We're actually going to hopefully have a conversation more in that roundtable hearing on Thursday. But we're looking for anything that where we've got something that needs to be cured in the bill beyond, you know, the amendments that have been put forward or any other aspects of the bill that you'd like to discuss with us.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think we'll probably try and keep this as brief as possible today, recognizing that there will be more opportunities. But in a nutshell, we would like to echo some of the comments made by previous folks who testified. I think that if I just run through the list, the ASHNA comments by Ms. Hultberg were, I thought, right on in terms of the fact that states that do health reform and do it well really do it continually, year after year after year. And there may be some things that we learn throughout the process that may help us to be able to make further improvements further the more time that has gone on. One of the things that I really appreciate or that we include my deputy in this conversation, that we really appreciate is the flexibility that is included in the bill. And it just allows us to be able to have more tools at our disposal to be able to address concerns. In particular, the 1915 I and K options that are included in the bill, we would support keeping those provisions in the bill because it allows us to do one more way of being able to provide services in a more efficient way to make sure that people get the care that they need, while at the same time saving the state general fund dollars is an opportunity that we as a state really should not pass up under any circumstances, but especially in a time where we recognize that we are having a budget challenge. The other is, as was mentioned by Ms. Burkhart, the 1115 option is another kind of tool that's available to the state. We are most immediately looking at that for options for a waiver for behavioral health services. We have certainly not been shy in all of our testimony over the last year that we really see that behavioral health is the key to being able to make the kind of change that we need to make in our health reform efforts. And so One of the things that I really appreciate about this bill is all of the flexibility that you have made available to the department that allow us to be able to tailor programs and services in a way that's most cost-effective and most efficient. And that's true in all times, but I think in our challenging financial times, it really makes sense to have a more comprehensive toolbox rather than start removing tools from the toolbox that really limit our ability to make meaningful change and meaningful reform.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for the record, I did want to state that I did not freak out when Ms. Burkhart described the 1915 I and K. I think she really did a pretty good job of explaining how it works and really kind of hit the nail on the head just in terms of where those opportunities were. So other than that, I didn't have anything additional to add.
Okay, great. But you did hear my request that we get some graphics to understand the services and what services, and also wanted to make sure that everybody is coming forward. And I just got a note because I did rush through a little bit of amendment number H9, and in there the behavioral health 1115 waiver is there to replace tribal waivers. So under that H9, so that's there. And yes, Representative Stutz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question that I asked last week that it may have skipped over. We were kind of involved anyway. I'm curious to know, or if you have any control over, how many dollars have actually been cut from the budget and how many dollars are transferring state dollars to federal dollars? If we could get some of that information, I'd appreciate it. And I thank you.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Stutz, we can provide you with that information. I know that over the last year's cuts as well as this year, the Medicaid program is taking about $100 million in general fund cuts. But we can provide you with more detail of whether those are cuts to programs or whether those are transfers to federal authority, et cetera. We'd be happy to provide that detail.
Thank you very much.
And we will try. We probably won't have it for Thursday, but in last year we had some charts made up that were showing what was the anticipated savings to general fund dollars, and another chart that was showing the amount of total funding that was expended in the state. So if you have ability to come graphically with that, that would be helpful. And of course, the part of the object of expansion and all was to make sure that we had more health services provided, but while cutting the general fund. So but it's good to know how much economic impact we're actually having on Alaska by those increased federal dollars supplying needed health care services. But we want to make sure that we're not providing unneeded services as well. Are there further comments or questions? Yes.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I did want to provide a little bit more updated information for the committee. We post on our website at dhss.alaska.gov a graphic that's just a one-page PDF. We'd be happy to provide it for the committee. It is refreshed every month. That includes the Medicaid data for that particular month so that the public can see how many folks are enrolled in Medicaid expansion through the end of that month, what are the demographics, how many are men, how many are women, how many are younger, how many are older, because all of those calculations went into our projections for Medicaid expansion. We also, though, do include some information for all Medicaid enrollees by region, as well as the demographics, similar demographics, how many men or how many women. But just in a nutshell, through the month of January, an additional 10,416 Alaskans were covered under Medicaid expansion, and we also paid out through the end of January $34.29 million in new federal reimbursements for Medicaid claims for those 10,416 Alaskans.
And that was federal dollars?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, yes. Through December of 2016, that's 100% federal dollars.
Okay, thank you. Representative Wolf?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question, Ms. Davidson. Those 10,000 enrollees, is that about what you expected at this point? Is it above, below your expectations? Where does it lie?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, that number is probably on track to where what we projected we would be by the end of state fiscal year 16. We anticipated that although about 42,000 Alaskans would be eligible, we thought around 22,000 people would actually enroll in the first year. We did see a little bit of an uptick or a little bit of a spike in the number of folks who enrolled that we would normally see this time of the year because of the individual insurance mandate. But the numbers are on track to what we projected.
So just to paraphrase, by the end of this year, you expect to be at 20,000, which was your prediction all along, right?
Mr. Chair, yes, we expect to be about 22,000. However, if that number is a little bit over, it just means that we also have more federal dollars coming into our state because in that first year of expansion, of course, it's 100% federal match. We also have on this graphic, just so you can see, this number, the $34 million in claims, $34.29 million in claims that were paid out through the end of January, this number will always lag a little bit because providers have a one-year timely filing limit. So what we generally see is that some of the smaller providers will send in their claims sooner. Some of the larger ones, like the larger hospitals, may wait until later in the year to be able to process those claims in larger batches. And then also there's a pie graph that shows that 54% of the people enrolled in Medicaid through the end of January were actually children, including 2% of children, of those children, of the 54% were children who experienced disabling conditions. And through the month of January, 8% of all Medicaid enrollees were due to expansion.
Thank you.
One thing that I note is that we're still getting a number of people saying that they just couldn't get enrolled or they just had a really hard time. And I'm wondering whether you've been able to reach out through, whether it's Ashna or whoever, that about enrolling through the Medicaid or through the federal exchange was the quickest way to get there. I haven't, you know, we've been telling people, constituents back home, that that's the way they should do it. But when I talked to the hospital today or yesterday, they were at that point of time unaware that the best way to do that would be get that done so it all electronically came to you and we weren't having people sitting there entering data and they could actually be processing applications. So have you had any fairly wide distribution of telling people that that is the mechanism that they should use for applying for Medicaid?
Mr. Chairman, we have done a number of outreach efforts, including there, it depends on, for the average person who's applying, probably the fastest way to do it is on healthcare.gov. And we have worked with Navigator organizations who are enrolling individual Alaskans in healthcare plans, whether it's through whether they're eligible for Medicaid expansion or whether they might be eligible for marketplace plans, because since we have become a determination state on healthcare.gov, that's the fastest way for an individual Alaskan to qualify. There is another way with hospitals that hospitals in Alaska sure are taking advantage of, which is to be able to do for an individual who's actually in the hospital that will allow them to be enrolled in Medicaid faster if a person is already in the hospital. And for quite frankly, for some folks who are in the hospital needing more intensive care, for that person, it may actually be faster to go that route rather than to healthcare.gov.
Sure. And, of course, the focus of this committee is to get primary care and get people signed up and getting appropriate health care through primary care. So we're hoping that as you go forward, we get that news out to people better so that they can, because we've just had a number of people that have, you know, just been frustrated by, you know, not being able to get through the phones or not being able to get the responses. I mean, you've got limited staff that are busy. So anyway, just wanted to put that out over there in case anybody's listening in the communities.
Sure. And so we appreciate that. And one of the other things, I will make a pitch, if I may, so shamelessly. If you know of anybody who is pregnant, we actually have a fast-track hotline, and we post it on our public assistance website. So if you know a woman who is pregnant and who needs coverage, we get those folks in as quickly as possible, because obviously if a woman has good access to good prenatal care, better outcomes for the mother, better outcomes for the baby. The other thing is just for so the public knows and so this committee knows as well, through the budget process last year, as you know, we were able to get some funds from the Mental Health Trust Authority to fund a number of positions that allowed us to be able to gear up for Medicaid expansion. Most of the positions were in the Division of Public Assistance. There were some additional positions that were in healthcare services to help process those claims as they came in. So we received $1.3 million from the Mental Health Trust Authority to be able to gear up. One of the things that also happened, though, last year through the budget process is through the Finance Committee process on the House side, $1.5 million was reduced from our budget in public assistance for positions that, quite frankly, help enroll beneficiaries in a number of public assistance programs. The reason at the time, the justification at the time was that since the ARES system, the new enrollment system for public assistance, which includes a variety of services, including Medicaid and Medicaid expansion, since that system was going to be automated, that those new positions, those existing positions could go away. Unfortunately, as we communicated to the committee, those changes weren't actually due to go into effect until 2017, and some of them not due to go into effect in 2018. So while we expected to have those additional $1.3 million in funds from the Mental Health Trust Authority to be able to add to the positions, when the $1.5 million came out of the budget to be able to accommodate a system change that wasn't in effect yet, we didn't end up with $1.3 million ahead. We ended up with $200,000 behind. So I'm certainly not making excuses for the department, because we have learned a long time ago that we do with what we have. But it certainly was a challenge to be able to step up to meet those new enrollment projections when we thought we were going to have more positions to be able to meet the demand, and actually ended up with a net fewer positions to be able to do that. But folks really stepped up to the plate and really did an amazing job getting folks enrolled with the resources that we had. And so if any of our public assistance folks are listening, or if you run into any of them, if you wouldn't mind smiling really big at them, they are on the front lines and have really, really put in a lot of time and a lot of effort to be able to help the state to realize this benefit.
Thanks. And I did, you know, make the statement for when you come back on Thursday, because we want to make sure that that same thing isn't happening this year in the use of federal funds under the change for especially transportation, because I know there's segments in several budgets that are counting on that. So we want to know what the time progress is on that.
Mr. Chair, I'd also like to add that the Division of Public Assistance also maintains a separate hotline for people who have medical urgencies. So if they have applied for Medicaid and then some urgent situation arises, they can call and let us know so that we know to work those applications promptly.
And is that through the 211 number, or is that do they need to go directly to the department?
That's on the Division of Public Assistance website. I can't say for certain whether the 211 number has that or not. So
okay. So do you have anything else for us, or we'll let you go and see you on Thursday?
Go on, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Thanks for the information. And I see Bruce Richards returned, and would you like to come forward? Welcome. Would you put yourself on the record and who you represent, and go ahead with your conversation with us?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify on HB 227. For the record, my name is Bruce Richards. I work for Central Peninsula Hospital. I'm the Director of External Affairs. And I just wanted to take this opportunity to thank you and the committee for taking up Medicaid reform. It's extremely important, obviously, with the budget considerations and things that are going on. But also, it is it's a time for the state to allow to set the stage for changing the payment models that are there. We're currently in a fee-for-service model, and your legislation here contains several demonstration programs that would allow for piloting different types of demonstrations. Central Peninsula Hospital is one of the hospitals that is working towards possibly piloting one of these demonstrations, and it would be found on page 8, section 12. Paragraph F, and this language authorizes a demonstration for a coordinated care demonstration that utilizes a global payment fee structure.
And just come on, just for everybody's information, that starts on line 27 on page 8. Is that what we're talking?
Correct. We've been working on this with Moda Health, one of the partners that we've been working with, this language in your bill would allow us to proceed forward in doing that. It's based on a current model that's currently operating in Eastern Oregon that Moda is involved in, and there's recently been some, and I've provided this to your committee staff, and I know you don't have this yet, but I've provided a narrative of that and some information about it. Some data released earlier this month in the Journal of the American Medical Association compared their 2011 baseline data with the 2014 data, and they show that there was a inpatient care costs had decreased by 14.8% per member per month. Spending on outpatient care was also lower by about 2.4%. Outpatient spending trends showed masked what was a 19.2% increase in spending on primary care services, but that shouldn't be unexpected. This is a primary care home-based model, and its focus is on primary care, and the whole focus of this program is to keep people healthy and keep them from becoming ill and spending those resources and misutilization of them. So that's to be expected. We also know that this model in Oregon is in Eastern Oregon anyways. There's several of them. They're done by regions there. We know that this model has reduced emergency room utilization by 21%. So it's pretty significant. We would anticipate a model that we're looking at in covering the entire Kenai Peninsula with the Medicaid population that's there. CCOs, or community care organizations, differ from a traditional accountable care organization, which is more closely associated with Medicare, not Medicaid. But they differ in the acceptance of full financial risk, which is a global payment. So This is something that you would receive an entire payment for the entire population. It's usually paid in a per member per month. And there's people that fall off and people that join in, so that's the way it's done, is on a per member per month. But they're also very similar in the fact that they're both locally governed, are accountable for access, quality, and health spending, and they both emphasize primary care medical homes, as previously stated. Both of them require robust data systems to support clinically integrated networks for clinical and business functions. The CCO would operate on a fixed global budget, reduce medical cost inflation as part of the contract, improve the quality of care and outcomes, and create a healthier population. We also believe the demonstration could help put Medicaid on a predictable and sustainable path by reducing the growth trend in the per capita Medicaid expenditures. The current Alaska trend of growth per capita for Medicaid expenditures averages just over 6% a year. We view the CCO as the next step beyond what's known as traditional managed care, and this belief is simply based on the funding structure and risk-bearing nature of the program. More importantly, providers will no longer be paid for treating illness, but instead for a highly coordinated system that prevents illness and the high costs associated with it. The CCO structure requires a great deal of front-end work, and that's stuff that we're working on with MOTA now. We certainly don't have it all put together yet, but it's something that we continue to work on with them. And it would bring stakeholders together, and we would need to agree on payment structures within the organization. We'll need to form a network, shared savings distribution program, develop quality targets and metrics for accountability that would be in the contract with the state. So we're currently in the process of analyzing the entire Medicaid population and want to better understand their needs so we can build a program that fits that population. And finally, I guess, Mr. Chairman, excuse me, I wanted to talked to your staff. One of the things that may come up later for an amendment is I wanted to suggest a minor language change which would provide the most flexibility for program design. And on page 8, line 27, if you were to look at following the word shall, it says design and implement. It says the department shall design and implement. And what we're hoping is that you possibly would consider deleting the words design and. This would allow the most flexibility for us to work with the department. They have plenty to do, and this bill would, as it's currently written, would require them to design the program and then push it out. And we're hoping that you may consider a change that would allow them to work with us as they develop an RFP so that we can be responsive to that RFP and not have any delays. So with that, I appreciate the committee taking up these very important issues. I know there's a lot of other things in your bill besides what I just described, and I know other people have testified to that, but I mostly wanted to cover the demonstration project that we're interested in looking at.
And I'm thank you, Bruce. Mm-hmm. Appreciate that. There are questions. And I hope you'll look over that amendment H.6 that we talked about. I don't know if you'd had to leave before we did that, but we were deleting design and implement a demonstration project and inserting contract with third party to establish care coordination. Oh, that's the other one? Okay. But we'll be looking at that for here too. So you have given that.
I have. I've provided to staff, and I know she just hasn't had the time to go through it all yet. So
I know I read almost the same language that we were looking at on the other demonstration project. Thank you, Bruce. I'm not seeing any questions, but I think a global payment model is really interesting. I know that when we had the last presentation, we had that continuum and chart and risk and everything, and it sounds like you guys are stepping right up to the highest full risk part of the model instead of somewhere between. So,
right. If you remember that slide, it started at a fee for service on the left, and if you were to continue all the way furthest to the right, would be the full risk global payment, and so it skips over everything in between.
Mr. Speaker.
Right. Representative Wolf.
Mr. Chair.
Right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question, and I don't know if this is the right time, but I will go for it anyways. and a global payment system, and as getting far away from this fee-for-service as you can. I understand the incentive in fee-for-service to A, charge, apply services, and I also understand the incentive for increasing fees in a fee-for-service system. Is there an incentive in a global system to decrease fees, or is there less pressure to do that? And does anyone foresee in a global system that fees would flatten or?
So, through the chair, Representative Wool, I think what this model that was certainly rolled out in Oregon, its main original goal was to flatten and bend the cost curve of the Medicaid spend that was going on in Oregon. And similar to Alaska, you know, that's a pretty steep curve. It's about 6% per year. And so the state of Oregon required these different community care organizations to reduce that by a certain percentage per capita.
Right.
So, and the incentive for the providers is to provide, you know, I guess the answer to your question as far as reducing fees, I think the bigger issue is flattening that cost curve.
Right.
I
guess in a global system, there isn't really a fee for service because, I mean, obviously you're only dealing with a certain population, but you're getting per month, per capita, whether they get services or not. And I don't know if in their internal bookkeeping they say, well, he had an MRI, he still gets his global rate, but we're going to sort of keep a tally of and I don't know. I don't know how it's going to work.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Wool. So it's still a little confusing. It would still continue to be a fee-for-service model.
Right.
We would get a global payment. The community care organization would get a global payment, but that payment would be distributed still through a fee-for-service mechanism. However, it would be done through a network that was comprised and put together by the CCO. And so there is the potential for savings and shared savings with those providers, and I guess that is it's still a fee-for-service model, except that the state is paying on a global level, and we're incentivized as the CCO to reduce the utilization of that population and reduce the cost per capita for each Medicaid enrollee.
Okay, thank you.
I know I've seen it on Southern Kenai Peninsula, I'm not sure about Central Penn, a vertical integration with primary care docs into the hospital setting. Is that something that is kind of integral to the global payment model, or is this going to, does it work with totally separate providers, not in the vertical integration?
So it's both. You know, at currently Central Peninsula Hospital, we have employed primary care providers. We also have interest. We've been, you know, talking to independent medical staff. We have some interest from independent physicians as well. So I guess the answer to your question is that it could be both. And you know, a lot of people think, well, how are you going to make this work? You won't have, you know, you're going to have specialists if you don't have a specialist employed. Well, that all gets kind of built, and would be negotiated. In some cases, people wouldn't be actually part of the network, but you're still going to need those services for the beneficiaries that are enrolled. And so, you know, that's kind of part of the cost of doing business. But your hope is that as a primary care-based model, you're going to prevent some of those occurrences from happening and therefore save those expenses that would be incurred by having to go to the emergency room or a specialist, you know, that maybe physical therapy, for instance, might prevent you from getting a back surgery or something along those lines. So I think that the answer to your question is that it can be both. It can be vertically integrated, but it also would include independent providers as well.
Okay. Are there further questions about this? Global payment model is something that would be really interesting demonstration pilot project around. So thanks again, Bruce. Is there anyone else in the room that would like to testify on House Bill 227? Is there anyone online to testify? Seeing no one else online. Committee discussion. Thursday we're going to have a roundtable. Secretary won't be taking notes. We'll be having a discussion with a number of providers that represent
all kinds of fields, including behavioral health and dental and all of the things, to make sure that we're pulling all the pieces of the bill together, and look forward to any, if any members are developing amendments, be happy to have those at any time so we can put them forward and get all the consideration when we'll have different providers and different specialties here to talk about those things. So anyway, at this time, nothing else to come before the committee. We will be adjourned at about 4:30.